Do you remember that when we were in school and we studied history, we learned what we were supposed to, and then we were tested on it. And that was, for most people, pretty much it. In fact, some of the students that actually scored the highest forgot the lessons the quickest. And I'm thinking, much like conscripted soldiers, they went at it well at first, but briefly. The ones that it was important to, however, the ones that history was important to, retain that knowledge. And we've heard this over and over again, and when we hear things over and over again, we tend to become numb to them, but we repeat the history that we forget. So I think it is good that we have people like Larry Kelly in the world to remind us that our behavior has really not changed, and the consequences for that behavior have not changed either. So if we want to see what the foundation of this behavior looks like, you take it back to the beginning, to the Greeks and to the Romans. And that's what we're doing tonight with Larry Kelly, his book, Lessons from Fallen Civilizations. We'll be right back with him right after this. This is Coast to Coast AM. Larry Kelly, it's really good to have you with us tonight as a first-time guest. I feel privileged to have you on because this is such a, I predict it'll be a seminal work. Let me ask you something. Does all this stuff have to be viewed in the rearview mirror? And what I mean by that is we never change. We keep doing it. Ongoing, rolling wars, the same problems over and over again. I mean, it seems like a civilization doesn't recognize it has a problem until after the devastation and has occurred and the rebuilding has begun. I mean, does a civilization even know that it has a problem?
Well, it's interesting that you brought that up because what you were saying about civilization repeating itself, it actually goes back to Thucydides. The fellow, I was telling the listeners about the Peloponnesian War, which was a 50-year civil war that was horribly debilitating for the Greek city-state, made them vulnerable to being taken over by Macedon, and the Greeks became a captive people for the next 2.5 millennia. But we hear the expression, those that don't know history are doomed to repeat it.
Yeah.
That's really, John, a kind of a bastardization of what Thucydides said.
Ah, that's good to know.
He said the notion that history repeats comes from him, which is amazing when you think of it. I mean, how did he know this? He knew that history would repeat because human nature doesn't change that much over the space of a few hundred years or even 1,000 years. How did he know that in the 4th century BC? It's amazing. But he said history will repeat because the nature of men doesn't change that much. So he says in the beginning of his book, that was the records of the Peloponnesian War, that because history will repeat, maybe my book will help you to deal with the inevitability of what will happen over and over and over again.
Yeah, it's almost as though if people don't get into it, there's got to be some sort of a shift in, I hate to use this expression because it's so, you know, it's descriptive and yet it's meaningless at the same time. There's just got to be a shift in consciousness among a sufficient number of people to effect this change.
Yes, I agree with you, and that's one of the reasons I wrote this book. Maybe the most important reason is that I'm not as fatalistic as Thucydides. I hope that we can be enlightened to the point where we can avoid some of these mistakes. That's why I'm right. The primary reason I wrote the book. I'm not as fatalistic as, in other words.
Well, I don't want to be fatalistic. It just seems that when these trends keep repeating themselves, yeah, it's the same trend over and over again. It's the same structure. It's the same participants in some cases. Just keeps going. I'm going, well, are we just like front row center captive audience for this movie and there's really nothing we can do about it? You know? And it makes me a little despondent. It's like that old. I'm sorry, man. We keep stepping on each other.
That's okay.
It's like, well, it's like that old that gal Lily Tomlin said one time. She said, no matter how cynical you are, you can never catch up. And that's stuck in my head like an engram. And I'm just looking at all this, going, I really do have faith in human beings, but I don't think people can change. I have seen it on occasion, but altogether, I don't think people can change. Roll with it.
Yeah. I can't say that I came to a final conclusion on that, John.
Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about something here.
Okay.
Immutable law number 6.
Okay.
To hold territory, a state must be populated by those loyal to the central authority. I would assume that would be their nation.
Yes.
When immigration overwhelms assimilation, the fall is predicted.
In, again, going back to the example of the Roman Empire in the West, the actual date, as I mentioned before, is 476 A.D., but in 379, at the Battle of Adrianople, the Emperor Valens was actually killed in that battle, and the battle was lost. And what had happened was, prior to that, the Roman Empire made the mistake of allowing an entire tribe, very large tribe of Goths, to enter the empire, to cross the Danube in Thrace, northern Greece, and they invited them to keep their commanders, to keep their language, to they were hoping to get them to act as a legion within the Roman Empire, but because they didn't assimilate them, they quickly became a band of brigands and began marauding through northern Thrace. They moved out of that area, up into northern Italy, down to southern Italy, and ultimately sacked Rome in 410 for the first time in 800 years.
You're using the word sacked.
Yes.
That means
they essentially surrounded the place, cut off all its food, and the inhabitants of Rome. There was a child emperor there at the time who had evacuated the place. But
I'll bet.
they essentially surrendered to the Goths. The head of the Goths was a fellow by the name of Alaric, but as I say, it was the first time that the city had been sacked in 800 years, and Rome represented a kind of an ideal throughout the world, the known Mediterranean world at least, and of course the civilized world was shocked.
Oh boy. Well. Now, as you know, we have an enormous immigration problem here, and many other countries around the world have them as well. As a matter of fact, the ones that are having the biggest immigration problem are the Western countries.
Yes,
that would be. I mean, everything.
Yeah, my modern corollary is today all across Europe, in Britain, Sweden, the Netherlands, Belgium, and France, there are huge numbers of no-go zones. There's over 180 in France alone. These zones are inhabited by unassimilated Muslims, where the police will not enter, where Sharia courts, where in place, where there's not even a Euro common law, and where, of course, homegrown terrorists are being cultivated. In 2008, British intelligence services were following 2,000 potential terrorists, 200 radical Islamic networks, and 35 active terrorist plots.
That's the thing. The lessons from fallen civilization, we're referencing the Greeks and the Romans a lot, but at the bottom of the cover of the book, it says, can a bankrupt America survive the current Islamic threat? And so that's where we're headed. As we go through the evening with you, This is kind of scary stuff, Larry. So just keep the progression going. Let's go from one immutable law to the next.
All right.
Because I don't think anybody needs a picture drawn. No one is going to say, okay, we can solve the nation's problems this way. Number one, we'll crank $50 billion that we don't have into a jobs program to our inner city, starting with them and moving out. This will eliminate crime. This will stimulate growth, rehabilitation of the living areas, everything. And the next smartphone that you buy will be made by highly trained American technicians, you know, who are no longer living in inner city squalor and misery. Number two, we will shut the borders and we will tell everybody who is not legally here out. Sorry, you're gone. See you later. You will immigrate legally or you will not enter. If you do, we will put you in a work camp and you will make stuff for us for really, really cheap. These are draconian measures. I'm making a science fiction novel here. None of this is ever going to happen.
Right.
All right. Number three, we audit the Fed, and when we find it to be in the trouble that we perceive it to be, we dissolve it and we go back onto another standard. Now, none of these things are going to happen. But a case could be made for one or all of these things to happen when we don't have so many immigrants here taking these smaller jobs. You're not supposed to despise small beginnings. You will work a lower level job until you are able to work an increasingly higher level job. You may be happy at a lower level job. It might be just fine. So how do you re-hardwire a society, Larry?
Well,
I realize I'm laying it on pretty thick here, but just, I know you're not, you don't have that glow going around you that's extraterrestrial glow, but you're a thinking man. What? How do you fix this thing? I mean, how do you get enough stuff going on to where, you know, almost like moving all of the pieces on the chessboard forward just a little bit? Because otherwise it's a piece at a time, and we don't have time for a full-length game.
Yeah. Well, the cost of government is such that Charles Krauthammer came up with a quote from a famous economist, and I didn't catch his name, but maybe it was Schumpeter or somebody, who said, if things can't go on, they won't.
Yeah, that's pretty good, actually. That pretty much says it all, doesn't it?
And so the situation is this. I have this in the book. It's a quote from Tom McClintock, who was gracious enough to allow me to interview him for the book, and he said essentially that when Bush left office, the cost of government was $2.9 trillion. It's now $3.7 trillion. So we're looking at a trillion-dollar deficits as far as the eye can see. If I were emperor, I would just say, you know, we're going to pare government back down to that level, or maybe just, you know, if it was, I thought it was a pretty good year in 1999, last year of Bill Clinton's administration. Maybe just go back to Bill Clinton's spending level. You know,
yeah.
I don't see how that's such a difficult thing. But here's what McClintock says. He says, if there is only enough money coming into the government right now to pay for these five things, that is Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the welfare programs, of which there's a lot, and interest on the debt. If we were not producing funny money, fiat money, there wouldn't be $1 to buy one bullet for one soldier's gun in the U.S. military, for example.
Whoa, that's pretty strong.
So, but to fix it really wouldn't be that hard. It's just that it's with our system the way it is now, John. With it, you know, with the polarization, with, you know, one group of politicians representing one set of constituencies and arrayed against the other, it's somehow politically, it's just not feasible. So The conclusion that I come up with is, although we have a not a democracy, a constitutional republic, it still isn't a guarantee that we survive.
Well, that's right. Constitutional republic and some action will get you what you want. But
possibly we might find a will to go back to a spending level that's sustainable. But right now, it's not. So that's what is got me the most worried at the moment.
Well, there are a number of things that have me worried about this. I'm afraid we may see an actual default.
Right.
I mean, and sometimes I think that there are factions within the government that want this. Let me just take us on a side trip for just a second. The hypocrisy that runs through the fabric of communication, even. But people talk about politics. It's like, I'm not interested necessarily in what's in what some committee and what this congressman or woman did this or this senator. I don't want to hear about the nuts and bolts of it. What I'm interested in is the effect on the people. I don't care who's doing it much. And I'll give you an idea of what I'm talking about. Just a couple of quick stories that just mix. And I it's an example from the media as well as from the political spectrum, which sort of dovetail into each other. Harry Reid, of all people, has supposedly written a piece into the Affordable Care Act, which I'm not really sure how affordable it is, but that's a topic for another time.
Right.
That ensures that there will be no compromising of the Second Amendment whatsoever. It's sort of a little secrets provision forbidding an executive order to regulate guns and ammo or collect any information and database it on persons who have these things. Now, why would Reid support such a thing?
I don't know.
Because Nevada is a pro-gun state.
Oh.
And so according to this writer, I believe it's Rick Unger, I want to say, politics will always trump ideology. Now, the thing I wanted to dovetail it in where the media is concerned is, guess who one of the sponsors of the biggest gun show in the United States called the SHOT Show is? NBC. This is widely reported. So when you're talking about the division between people and the labeling that we were talking about earlier, I mean, it brings to mind that old song, "Don't Know Much About History." People really don't know about history, and I'm worried that there's a collective apathy, not really an apathy, but a feeling of helplessness, like we cannot get enough people on the same page at the same time to affect any real change, because no matter what, it's going to have to go through our elected officials.
Yes.
Well, so we got to wait 2 years to elect some more, or what?
The problem as I see it is that there was a fellow by the name of Alexis de Tocqueville came over to the... He was a kind of a European, widely read guru that came over to the U.S., traveled around for about 10 years, because the people that were living in the monarchies in Europe were, just dying to know what was going on the ground in America in the 1820s, a couple decades after the Revolution. And he coined, in making his observations about the U.S., he coined the phrase "the tyranny of the majority."
Yeah.
And in that he essentially warned this. He said, if Americans, he said in very flowery 19th century language, but he said in essence, if the Americans learn to vote themselves a paycheck, he called it robbing from the country's largesse, the republic is doomed. And that may be the problem that we're really facing here.
Who said that,
Larry? We have a majority of people who don't mind looting their neighbors' largesse. We may have reached that tipping point. Is the point?
This is very interesting, Larry. I'm enjoying this a lot. I'm getting a lot of email here. A lot of other people are enjoying it too. So we'll come back and we'll talk about immutable law number 7. This is really quite a good one. Let's just lay back for a second here and go get yourself a proper cup of tea and plan on getting back into your history book. It may serve you well. The quicker the word spreads, the quicker we may be able to do something for ourselves. This is Coast to Coast AM. Breathe deep. You know, what's interesting is a quote that was sent by friend Scout. A democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until the voters discover they can vote themselves largesse from the public treasure. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidates promising the most benefits from the public treasury, with the result that a democracy collapses over loose fiscal policy, always followed by a dictatorship. That's from a French diplomat and historian in the early 19th century from his book, Discovery of America, Tocqueville. Okay, we'll be back with Larry Kelly in just a moment. This is Coast to Coast AM. Thanks for being here. Money, money, money. Everybody's worried about the money. In talking with Larry Kelly about his book, Lessons from Fallen Civilizations, the immutable law number 7, with the loss of fiscal solvency comes a loss of sovereignty. And America would need to borrow $1.5 trillion in fiat money before it could pay one soldier's salary or fuel one fighter jet as of 2011. Is that right?
It's about right, yes. According to Tom McClintock. Yes, John.
And 70% of Americans believe the country was headed in the wrong direction, a euphemism for decline. Well, if 70% of the Americans feel like the country's in decline or headed the wrong direction, then that means 70% of the people are willing to change the direction. I'm just wondering how this is actually accomplished.
Yeah, I don't know, because at the same time, I just heard recently that Barack Obama's approval rating is in the 50s. So yeah. How does that comport with 7 out of 10 tell pollsters they think that the country's headed in the wrong direction? I guess that might mean that some people just don't think that they're doing enough of the transfer of wealth. I don't know.
I hope it's that Mark Twain thing about their statistic, their lies, damned lies, and statistics. I hope it's that.
Yes, right. I don't know. I mean, polling can be not a very exact science, or there's a lot of polling that's done to achieve a result that is already a result that the pollster is looking to find. So I don't pretend to be an expert either.
No, I don't either. I just kind of sift through this stuff like everybody else does, and go to good sources like yourself. And now your book came out in 2012, yeah?
May.
In May, so about halfway through. So when you were making these references to 2011, that's like week before last. I mean, time is going by so fast, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
But this thing with China being unwilling to invest in any more of our debt, and you know, you hear this talk about, I mean, sometimes I think they must be joking. We're going to make a $1 trillion coin, and then it will be imbued with this power, you see, because it will be the coin that's worth $1 trillion. And then we can just start leveraging some of our expenses against this magic coin. I mean, is anybody really even serious about this? This is amazing to me that we're even talking about it.
I know. I was having dinner with a couple friends shortly after Obama won his first election, and it was obvious that we were going to get this huge, stimulus. I didn't know then that it would be institutionalized, that we weren't going to just spend $1 trillion that we didn't have in the Treasury in, 2009, but that it would be institutionalized and be the amount of money over and above what we take in every year. But nevertheless, I said to my friends who don't agree with me politically, I said, this can't work. Logically, it cannot work. Think of it this way. If this were to work, just spending $1 trillion that we don't have to, stimulate the economy and create work and jobs and so forth, And any country could do that. Cameroon, Tajikistan could do the same thing. Why couldn't they do it? Why couldn't they just pay everybody in their country, who it's a very, very poor country, but why can't they just, come up with a fiat money and pay everybody $100,000 a year?
Yeah.
Or $1 million a year and make everybody a millionaire?
Absolutely.
If this logically could work.
It's interesting, I'll tell you that. All right, I'll tell you what. Let's move to immutable law number 8. Debasing the currency always destabilizes the governing authority. What do you mean by that?
What happened in the 3rd century during the Roman Empire was well chronicled. The Roman treasury began minting coins with lead in the center. And it became known that that's what they were doing, that they were debasing the currency, and pretty soon nobody would accept Roman currency. And the empire kind of ground to a halt because the most important thing that the treasury was set up for was to pay the legions, to pay for the defense of the empire. And so they quickly had to call back all of the coins, because everybody was just doing, they were just bartering. It became a barter economy because the citizenry lost faith in the coinage and therefore in the government itself, ground to a halt. They couldn't pay their soldiers. So they quickly had to bring all the coins back in and melt them all down, get all the lead out. I think that's where the expression comes from, get the lead out. I don't know.
But, maybe. Probably does.
And so then the Roman Empire could continue to function. But that's just a case in point. Now, my modern corollary is this. Since the United States completely abandoned the gold standard in 1971, the buying power of the dollar has plunged by 96%. It's an amazing number, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
In 1971, an ounce of gold sold for $35. By 2011, an ounce of gold sold for $1,500.
I mean, what does this tell us exactly? Nothing good. You know, it does give me an idea, though. Maybe I could make my own coin, take it over to the bank and go, that's my coin. They go, what do you mean? So, this is worth $1 billion. I want to borrow a little money against it. Say, that is a pretty good-looking coin. Maybe we can do something. Are you sure it's worth $1 billion? Oh, absolutely. I mean, I challenge you to make up something more idiotic. It's yeah. Baffling to
me. Well, the assumption that everybody is making is that with all of this money that's been pumped into the economy, I think I've forgotten the starting point, but I think it was from 1970 to the present. We've spent $76 trillion, and we've taken in $60 trillion. So that $16 trillion debt is the shortfall that we have amassed. We literally now have a debt of $16 trillion, which is roughly the same size as our entire gross domestic product. And McClintock told me in the interview, he said, we also now, because of this, we have experts come to the committee and who are experts in the macroeconomic world, in the world of the world's economy, I guess. And they all tell us that we have between 2 and 4 years before we have what he called a debt crisis. So I said to Congressman McClintock, I said, well, what is a debt crisis? What does it look like? What's
the meaning of this?
What transpires in a debt crisis?
Yeah.
And he really didn't want to say. He wanted to be, I think, vague for the reason that he didn't want to cause, he didn't want to be the cause of the loss of faith in the banking system. That's my theory. He just said, we won't be able to borrow. We won't be able to create money. Well, I still didn't understand exactly what he meant, but I think for reasons that I just stated, I think that's why he wanted to keep that vague.
Well, yeah, it might not do much for your career path. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for his. I mean, yeah, he has a responsibility not to create panic.
Panic. That's just the word, panic.
I guess it is.
I'm afraid it is. All right. Let's move on, shall we? And then we're going to get into some real serious stuff here in our last hour.
Okay.
This has been a really nice long conversation with you, Larry. His website, again, is larrykelly.com. That's two E's in Kelly, one beside the Y and one beside the K. Immutable law number 9. When a civilization accepts the propaganda of its enemy as truth, it has reached the far side of appeasement, and capitulation is nigh. Who is this enemy?
My reading of history is, we were talking about the ruthlessness. There's always a ruthless enemy outside the walls of civilization. There's always an enemy there, ready to come in, and if they perceive that you are weak enough to be taken. There's always somebody that will want to take your stuff.
Does the appearance of comfort and wealth encourage this sort of attitude from the barbarians on the other side of the gates?
Yes, that is my reading. That as long as there's been civilizations, there's been people who have been docile enough to want to hold on to what they have to the extent that they will attempt to appease the ruthless, and that is when they.
Off with your head and take your stuff.
When they lose their stuff, you know.
Yeah, and their heads.
Yeah, and my correlation there is we thought that the Arab Spring was going to be, you know, was going to mirror, you know, our revolution, that our ideals were going to be what would take the place of these despotic regimes, and in the Middle East, we took the side of those that were attempting to bring down these regimes, never dreaming that what would replace them is an even more dangerous, ruthless, implacable enemy.
Well, yeah, that's what it appears to me, and it seems that they're, I don't know, from where I'm sitting, just trying to analyze things, it looks like they're having plenty of help from this side of the ocean. I'm wondering about this this brazen attack on Benghazi. You know, who is responsible for the misinformation or whatever is less importance to me, and I think of less moment altogether than the motivation behind the attack to begin with. And first thing I reach for is, well, destabilization in that region, and then the insertion of the influence of the Muslim Brotherhood. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, no, there was a desire on the part of the administration to not face, to accept the propaganda that this was just a bunch of people that were outraged at a video, never wanting to actually realize that this was the most ruthless attack on American soil since 9/11 by the same, pretty much the same enemy, Al Qaeda. You know, they've morphed into, you know, a bunch of imitators of the original Al-Qaeda set up by bin Laden, but they're essentially the same enemy.
Well, right here in your book, I'll just read from it, just a couple of lines here. While a storm gathered around our only reliable ally in the Middle East, the president of the free world took the side of the Muslims. They pretended to be outraged by Israel building some new houses in Jerusalem, its ancestral capital, 2,500 years. failing to observe that no other country in human history continually attacked by its surrounding enemies could survive if it operated its capital city and foreign policy according to the dictates of those same enemies. And the fact that our leadership made the case that Israel, one of America's most important allies, should do so, represented the far side of the appeasement. Now, when people start calling you Zionist and this and that and the other, how do you respond to that? Because they will.
Yeah, I got an email today. I don't see it as, you know, Zionism was a term coined when the British were attempting to, after World War II, to set up a holy land for the Jews. And I don't see it as an insult, but maybe other people do. I don't. Do you call me a Zionist? I'm for the repatriation of the Jews to their holy land.
Okay. Well, that's okay, and I wanted to just address that because, you know, look, I'm a face your giants kind of person. It's like if I know that somebody's, you know, there's enough suggestion out there that we're headed a direction that I do not wish to infer we are heading, then I'll just call myself out on it. So, I mean, it's just in the interest of objectivity and I just say, when I just ask you if people say that, what do you say? It's like, yeah, I think they should have their own homeland. If that makes me a Zionist, then okay. I get it. I mean, I'm alternately a Nazi, a Zionist, a left-winger, a right-winger, you know, a gun nut and an appeaser, depending on what piece of what sentence somebody might hear. You can't, you know, some people have better cognitive listening skills than others. But anyway, I digress. Let's go on to immutable law. We don't really have time. I'll tell you what. Let's just take a minute, and let me ask you this. If one wanted to buy your book, where would they go?
The best place really is the website, because when you open the page, you'll see the cover of the book there, and just beneath the cover of the book, it says order on Amazon. You click on that. That's a hyperlink and takes you right to the Amazon page.
I'll tell you what, that Amazon, they're just into everything, aren't they?
Yeah.
They really are. It's amazing. I remember when they first fired up, and the company was worth like $2 billion, and they hadn't sold anything. I was like, "What? I got to watch this." And that's amazing.
It is remarkable. That's really the easiest way to get the book, is just go to LarryKelly.com.
Okay, now as part of your bona fides here, it says former adventurer. Just take a minute and tell us what sort of adventures, would put you in the category of adventurer.
When I was younger, I was a surfer, and I went to
When you said surfer, you slipped into almost surfer lingo. You kind of relaxed on surfer like you were visualizing yourself on the board. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I traveled to some rather remote third world locations to find, you know, surf that, you know, hadn't been charted then.
You were in search of the unknown wave.
The endless summer. Mm. And yes, and the I actually found in Costa Rica a mile long left. The wave was so long that you at the end of the ride, you got out of the water and you walked back up the beach.
Oh, man. Oh, dude. I have to dude you on that one.
And you
found the monstro wave.
Yeah, I surfed in Morocco. We traveled all the way down to the bottom of Morocco. At the time, it was the country to it went south was the Spanish Sahara, as it was called then.
Wow.
And you know, we surfed while we kind of contemplated the Sahara. The Sahara was like an ocean as well. Both the Sahara and the ocean in front of us, it had similar properties, seemingly endless.
That's unbelievable. When we come back, I want to hear about your influence in skateboard design, too. Larry Kelly is our first-time guest tonight on Coast to Coast AM. He's a former surfer dude, and he found the Monstro Wave. I think that's fantastic. I've never surfed. That's on my bucket list. His book is Lessons from Fallen Civilizations. We'll be right back. This is Coast to Coast AM.